Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Dr. Koop, it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
First of all, you're certainly a household name in the field that I'd like to ask you a couple questions about, and that's bioethics. Probably nobody in this country has given more thought, done more research, and put more, spilled more ink on this subject than yourself. Knowing scripture and knowing the sciences, how important is it before Christians become activists on any of these subjects that they are able to integrate both the science and the medicine and understand both?
I think the first thing that anybody has to do on this subject is to understand that all that science can say has not yet been said, nor has all that Christianity can say been said. So we are in a work in progress. And if we were talking 50 years ago, I would be giving you an entirely different answer than I would today on the basis of what science knew or what we knew about theology. Mm. And the way that people begin to integrate them without shame. There was a time when you either were on one side or the other, but now more and more scientists are saying, well, I think they have something on their side. And especially as two things happen. One, that evolutionists are so likely to fall into the trap of saying yes to anything that sounds to be the party line. And they don't realize that the intricacy of, let's say, the human body, the human hand, the human eye, there haven't been enough years yet for that evolutionary process to take place at the rate we know evolutionary processes are supposed to take place. So if you're a mathematician, you really should be a believer because your mathematics tells you what they are telling me happened couldn't have happened in the short 30 million years that they think it happened over. So I try to approach these things fundamentally with my basic religious belief, which I cannot change and which I cannot compromise. And one of the answers I have to give sometimes is I don't know, but this is what I think. But on most bioethical issues, remember that people who give bioethical opinions don't really know any more than you and I do, but they have a title that they gave themselves. I'm a bioethicist. And what's the training to be a bioethicist? It's looking at case histories of bioethical problems. And so eventually it comes down to situational ethics for every single instance. But I think those of us who believe the scriptures know that there are absolutes, and we can't tread on those.
Absolutes, I think, are easy to affirm in theory, but what happens when you come to cases such as, abortion in the case of the life of the mother, or you come to fetal stem cell research? Even staunch pro-life advocates have difficulty knowing exactly where to stand sometimes on some of these line calls. How do you, as not only a theoretician, but someone to whom presidents and others go for advice on this, how do you wrestle both theologically and medically with these questions when they're in the gray area?
Well, maybe I should tell you an anecdote that I think explains it well to me and might to your audience as well. When I was Surgeon General, I had to make a lot of pronouncements, a lot of decisions that did not please everybody. In fact, you might say that, like the words of Jesus, I always divided the audience, usually about in half. And under those circumstances, you can't get away from your fundamental religious belief in the things that make you tick. But for abortion, it has never been difficult for me once I understood what I was talking about. And the reason I'm approaching this anecdotally is I am sure that this has happened to other people too. I used to teach a class at 10th Presbyterian Church on bioethics. And I'm ashamed of myself for what I used to do. I used to take a line, draw it straight across the blackboard. And most of my students were elderly women, so they were not really interested in abortion. But I would say, here's my position on abortion. I'm against it. But there are certain times that my compassion for a mother who's about to raise a deformed child, or any one of a number of things, overcomes my feelings against abortion. And I said that many, many times, Michael. And one day I was giving a talk at a Christian college on the West Coast. I was standing in the pulpit of the chapel, and I started to say the same old party line. And it suddenly struck me that it did not conform to what I thought God believed. Because I think the Bible screams from cover to cover that life is precious to God. And so I closed my notes and I walked around in front of the pulpit and I said, when it comes to abortion, my position is essentially Roman Catholic, except that I'm not a Roman Catholic. Then I went on and I really spoke from my heart what I thought about it. Life begins at conception. The only thing that stands between a fertilized egg and you is nutrition. And to say that a bat or a bumblebee or a baboon has life beginning at conception, but when you get to the highest form of life, a human being, they say, well, we're not sure when life begins. It might be at 6 weeks, it might be at 3 months. And until then, it really is just some membranes. And the semantics around the pro-choice movement have been downright false.
And, from a scientific medical perspective?
Yeah, when a little tiny embryo has a heartbeat, it has electrical waves coming off its head, it has fingerprints. If you poke it with a needle, it retracts with pain. And in spite of all that evidence, all of the arguments before the Supreme Court for Roe v. Wade talked about some membranes. Well, they knew they weren't membranes, but there are a lot of women today who have abortions who think they're getting rid of a few membranes. So abortion has never been a big problem for me. I was probably the most outspoken doctor in America in 1971-72, and I continued that right up through the time that I made the five movies with Francis Schaeffer on whatever happened to the human race, that essentially was on abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, and the Christian alternatives there, too. Now, when you come to the issue of stem cell research, that is an extraordinarily difficult issue. But let me flat-footedly say first, before I say anything else, what the facts are in this particular argument. The average American, I think, believes if you had stem cell research tomorrow, that you could take a few stem cells and put it in their grandmother's brain and their Alzheimer's disease would get over. They believe if you did ditto with Parkinson's disease, the same thing would happen. And I guess they think if it doesn't do that, it doesn't do anything. But let me tell you the facts. If you could put stem cell research into high gear tomorrow, it would probably be 10 years before you could use it against Alzheimer's disease. Of the people that have been treated with stem cell transplants who have Parkinson's disease, one half of them have not benefited by it, and the other half are much, much worse than they were before. So you now have people who were living a life and now are totally incapacitated. And the other thing that I think was unnecessary, you know, when you do experiments that are experimental, in the sense that you're trying to prove without a shadow of a doubt that what you did caused the effect, then you do a sham. And so for all the people that had a Parkinson's disease operation by having their skull opened and the stem cells planted at the right spot, there were other patients who had their heads open and they had their brain probed, but no stem cells were left behind. Now, I think that was a tremendous effort to prove something that could have waited a little bit of time without subjecting those people to a craniotomy and all the deleterious effects that can come from that. Now, that's fact, and that's one of the reasons that I don't favor stem cell research. I think that George W. Bush had a very difficult task when he had to make a decision, because if you think about the other side's arguments, the stem cells that we have came from lines of embryos that were created in the process of trying to get a sterile family pregnant. And because the risks are so great to the procedure, they always make more embryos, if they can, than they need. So they might carry one or two embryos to term as a single child or as twins, but they have six left over. And you can freeze them and work on them years later, and they still behave the same way they did the first time. Now, you could argue, in the long run, these babies, whether you believe how they were created or not, doesn't matter. But we have them now. They're serving no useful purpose. They're never going to become people. They're never going to be implanted in anybody else's uterus. So why don't we use them? And that's a very legitimate argument. And Mr. Bush believed it. And he said, that's a good argument, and I think we should do it, but only on the stem cell lines that are now in place. And we do not create any more embryos to get it. But my point philosophically is, when you do something that changes the social acceptance of something that the layman doesn't know as much about as the scientists do, you have to be concerned about one magnificent question. If we do this, what is the next step likely to be? Well, if I can go back to the theme of whatever happened to the human race, abortion came along in 1973, and you have to think, for example, one of the things that followed that is the medical school class that started about 9 years ago grew up in this country not knowing that abortion was once illegal and that abortionists were frowned upon as the sleaziest people alive. So when you say you shouldn't abort, I say, well, why not? And that's understandable. But out of abortion came a very relaxed opinion of the sanctity of human life. And the next thing that happened is we had babies who were born with a major defect, not offered to surgeons for correction, but put in the corner of the nursery to die. And so we had infanticide, and it was practiced to greater degrees in some countries. In Great Britain, for example, for economic reasons, although hydrocephalus can be treated with a shunt, I happen to be the guy that put the first shunt in, so I know all about that, and you can get perfectly normal and wonderful people out of it. But they decided that they would not treat children with hydrocephalus. Usually starts with spina bifida. And the sad thing about it is that the decision was made by Parliament and having a National Health Service, which is a government program. If Parliament says it, Parliament does it, and the doctors do what they're told. And in a country where, when the day I'm talking about, you didn't have a choice of going into the private sector, you were stuck with whatever the government said to do. And those children are born, and they become part of a conspiracy. The student nurse is not told that it's the government policy and the National Health Service's policy not to feed them. And that's how they handled the situation of an expensive operation that required years and years of follow-up and so forth.
So much for do no harm.
Do no harm. Now, to use that same question that I asked you, if we do this today, what is the next step likely to be? Well, I don't think you have to be very much of a prophet or have a great deal of understanding of foreknowledge to realize if today you agree it's okay to use stem cells from embryos that were going to be discarded, the next step is to say, well, if we've proven that this is a good thing to do, why shouldn't we use stem cells from embryos that aren't going to be discarded. Therefore, the next step is, let's make some embryos, and human life is threatened once again. And we're producing a living organism that one day will be a you or a me if it's left alone. And yet, what is being done to that child, and I do call it a child and I do it advisedly, you are really doing something of an experimental nature on an individual for whom it can have absolutely no benefit except death.
Dr. Koop, you go back how many years with what is now the Alliance? Tell us a little bit about that and perhaps why you, with all of your responsibilities, you've come back.
Well, first of all, I at the request of President Reagan, I became his Surgeon General, and I was so designated on Valentine's Day of 1981. And up until that time, I had been, for 25 years, the president of what was called first the Evangelical Foundation, and then secondly, Evangelical Ministries. So I go pretty far back, far enough back to remind you that the magazine that preceded Eternity was called Revelation, and then Eternity came along, and it was Dr. Barnhouse's idea, if Time magazine was such a success for the secular world, what a thing to say, we have Eternity, read us. And your audience might be interested in this, and people in general don't know it, but we did a bunch of studies hiring somebody to do it for us who was a good theological scholar on what we call the cults. And a lot of people wrote in and said, why haven't you done a study on the Seventh-day Adventists? And Barnhouse was a very forthright man and not the least bit wimpish about saying something in which he fantastically believed. And so his response was, in Eternity magazine, to say, I do not consider Seventh-day Adventism to be a cult. We are going to be in heaven with the Seventh-day Adventists, and then they will realize that their legalism had nothing to do with it. And we had so many people among our readers that didn't want to be in heaven with the Seventh-day Adventists that our circulation just dropped off. We hung on for a number of years and tried, and we finally folded because Barnhouse publicly defended Seventh-day Adventism of not being a cult. But we had, in the early days, a much smaller ministry than the Alliance is today. I was a very close friend of James Montgomery Boyce, and when he was talking about the first meeting of the what became the Alliance in Cambridge, he made it so appealing that I made a gift to make that conference a possibility. And then I said, I guess if I did that, I can be invited, can I? So I went to it, enjoyed it very much, and I've been kind of interested in its outcome since. The older I get and the more I study the Word of God, the more I realize that there is only one interpretation of what the Bible says, and that is embodied in what we call Reformation theology. And I am absolutely distressed about two things: the way the world is going downhill. What do I mean by that? In today's paper, you find 255 children are involved in pornographic rings, for nothing to satisfy but the greed of the people who use them. We find lack of integrity in members of Congress, in the President of the United States. I saw in a headline someplace that next year, when the new television shows open, two of them will be shows hosted by a medium who will be having conversations with dead celebrities. So if you look at what's happening in everything that the scriptures tell you you shouldn't be involved with, they're becoming more and more part of regular life. And I think it's extraordinarily tough to be a teenager today. It's always been tough to be a teenager. But let your mind wander a bit and think you were a teenager today and compare the temptations you have today that you didn't have when you were a teenager. And I felt that although I'm 85 years old and have more than enough to do, that I couldn't think of anything in the Christian world that captured my attention more than the Alliance, or whose work I really thought was more important than anything else going on right now.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorseinn.org.